You are listening to Professor Noam Chomsky speaking at the Chomsky on Gaza Public Forum on Tuesday, January 13, 2009, at the Wong Auditorium at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the United States. The event was sponsored by the MIT Center for International Studies and its program on human rights and justice, and was recorded under the Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike License 2009 by Jason Pramus for Open Media Boston, www.openmediaboston.org.
Okay, thank you for waiting. I'm John Tierman of the Center for International Studies, which is sponsoring this talk today, along with the program on human rights and justice. Before we begin, a few quick announcements. One is that we will have some time for questions at the end of Professor Chomsky's talk. And what we'll do is, at the end of the talk, we can line up on either side in front of the microphone, I think is the best way to do it, and we'll just go back and forth with questions, I hope, rather than statements or manifestos. The center is sponsoring a couple of talks that are potentially of interest to this audience in the next month or so. One is coming on January 29th. I think late afternoon. You'll have to check our website for exact time and location. On refugees, a remarkable book assembled on refugees, refugee voices by the actress Mia Kirshner, and she will be here actually for an IAP activity for the next 2 weeks, starting next week, and we'll cap it off with a public talk. That's on the 29th. And then on the 19th of February, we will have Eyal Weitzman, who is a Israeli architect and critic, social critic, who will be here, also a late afternoon lecture on February 19th. Again, location you can find on our website. Today I am introducing the man who needs no introduction, so I won't give him much of one except to say that we're really delighted that Noam Chomsky can join us today. Certainly one of the world's most important intellectuals and activists, and speaking today on a subject he knows well. So please help me in welcoming Noam Chomsky.
As you know, on Saturday, December 27th, the latest U.S.-Israeli attack on hopeless Palestinians was launched. It had been meticulously prepared. We know from the Israeli press that both aspects of the campaign had long been carefully prepared, both the military aspect and the propaganda aspect, learning from the lessons of the 2006 invasion of Lebanon, which it was argued was not planned well from a military point of view and was not advertised properly. So this time both of those aspects were under control with extensive programs, and that means we can be reasonably confident that anything that's happening or that is said is purposeful. It's planned that way. Maybe not everything, but most of it. One thing that was planned carefully was the time of the launching of the war. It was carefully chosen. It was shortly before noon on Saturday when children are returning from school and crowds are milling around in the streets of densely populated Gaza City. And it took only a few minutes to kill well over 200 people, and wound around 700, which is an auspicious opening to the mass slaughter of defenseless civilians trapped in a tiny cage with nowhere to flee. That was Saturday, December 27th. Last Saturday, 2 weeks later, Israel barred humanitarian shipments to Gaza Strip because we have to, after all, honor the holy days. None of this is at all surprising. It's familiar. Just to mention one parallel, which is relevant, I'll come to it later. In June 1982, when Israel launched its U.S.-backed invasion of Lebanon, the first target attacked was the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, later to become famous because of a major massacre. The bombing hit the hospital, the Gaza hospital, killed more than 200 people. That was the opening day of the invasion, which killed maybe 15,000 to 20,000 people, destroyed much of southern Lebanon, large parts of Beirut. It was able to proceed as usual because of U.S. support, U.S. authorization, U.S. arms, diplomatic support, which included vetoing a series of Security Council resolutions calling for an end to the carnage. The aggression was undertaken, also as usual, and as conceded, in fact, to defend Israel, namely from the threat of a peaceful political settlement. That's contrary to much routine deceit in the United States, particularly, but it's all so well documented, it's hardly necessary to talk about it. All of this is normal, and it's not concealed by high Israeli officials. Just to give one example, 30 years ago, the chief of staff of the army, Mordechai Gur, pointed out that, quote him, since 1948, we have been fighting against a population that lives in villages and cities. Israel's major military analyst, Zev Schiff, summarized his remarks. He said, the Israeli army has always struck civilian populations, purposely and consciously. The army, Gur said, has never distinguished civilian from military targets, but has purposely attacked civilian targets. And the reasons were explained right at the same time by distinguished statesman Abba Eban, considered a dove. He said there was a rational prospect, ultimately fulfilled, that affected populations would exert pressure for the cessation of hostilities, satisfying Israel's goals. Eban happened to be commenting on a speech by Menachem Begin, which presented a picture, Eban said, of an Israel wantonly inflicting every possible measure of death and anguish on civilian populations in a mood reminiscent of regimes which neither Mr. Begin nor I would dare to mention by name. Eban did not contest the facts. He criticized Begin for speaking about them so frankly, which could be harmful to the Israeli image. His own views, which I just quoted, could also be attributed to countries that we dare not mention by name. Well, as the latest U.S.-Israeli assault on Gaza began, a small boat, the Dignity, was traveling from Cyprus to Lebanon. There were doctors and human rights activists aboard, and they intended to violate Israel's criminal blockade and to bring supplies to the trapped population. The boat was intercepted far out at sea in international waters. The Israeli Navy rammed it without warning, severely damaged the boat. It managed to limp to a Lebanese harbor. Israel provided the routine lies, terrorists, etc., and claimed that the boat wasn't rammed. But unfortunately for the propaganda system, there were respected journalists on board, including CNN correspondent Carl Penhall, who reported. There were other Al Jazeera reporters, but Penhall was hard to dismiss, though he was dismissed. Also aboard was Cynthia McKinney, the former representative, presidential candidate for the Green Party. She and other passengers verified Carl Penhall's account, which I've just stated. This is all quite a serious crime. For example, ramming and almost sinking a boat in international waters is a much more serious crime than piracy off the coasts of Somalia, for example. It received very little notice, you know, a few words here and there, which reflects a tacit acceptance of the principle that Israel is authorized to carry out crimes on the high seas in order to defend itself against any interference with its illegal military occupation by trying to provide some succor to the victims. Also tacitly accepted is that the Gaza Strip is occupied territory. That is, Israel has a right to impose a siege on it. Well, that lack of attention, again, makes good sense. It's all very familiar. For decades, Israel has been hijacking ships in international waters between Cyprus and Lebanon, killing passengers, kidnapping them, many of them brought to Israel, some held as hostages for a long time, imprisoned, sometimes in the secret prison torture chambers, which have been exposed in Israel and Europe, but not reported here. And it's known, you occasionally see a mention of it in U.S. commentary, but never considered very serious. So there's no particular reason why this new crime should be greeted with anything more than a yawn. These regular practices are quite significant. They underscore the utter hypocrisy of the standard claim that Israel had the right to invade Lebanon once again in 2006, fifth invasion, because soldiers were captured at the border. Actually, as I say, this has been Israeli practice over many years. It's been far more extreme, killing, intercepting ships, killing people there, capturing them as hostages. All of that is far more extreme crime than capturing soldiers at a border post. Think what you do about that, but it doesn't rank anywhere near it. So if that justifies the invasion, which once again devastated southern Lebanon and parts of Beirut, if principles operated, you can draw your own conclusions, but fortunately they don't operate, fortunately for the U.S. and its clients. This cross-border operation of Hezbollah in 2006 was its first cross-border action of any kind in 6 years since Israel had withdrawn from southern Lebanon, where it had occupied southern Lebanon with U.S. support for 22 years in violation of Security Council resolutions. Meanwhile, Israel daily violates the border throughout these 6 years, as indeed it is doing today. And again, that's with impunity and nothing more than a yawn, if it's even mentioned. Well, these new crimes that began on December 27th, they don't fit easily into any of the standard categories, except for one, namely familiarity. They do fit into that category. I've given a couple of examples, and if there's time, I'll return to more. Literally, the current U.S.-Israeli invasion falls under the category of terrorism, at least according to the U.S. official definition of the word, but that does not capture the enormity of the crime. It cannot be called aggression, and the reason is that it's taking place in occupied territory, that's accepted in the West tacitly, and it's basically beyond question. It's recognized by Israeli scholarship. So the most important case I know is the one and only comprehensive scholarly history of Israeli settlement in the occupied territories. It's been translated now into English, called Lords of the Land by Edith Zertel and Akiva Eldar. They point out that, quote, after Israel withdrew its forces from Gaza in August 2005, the ruined territory was not released for even a single day from Israel's military grip or from the price of the occupation that the inhabitants pay every day. Israel left behind scorched earth, devastated services, and people with neither a present nor a future. The settlements were destroyed, the Jewish settlements, in an ungenerous move by an unenlightened occupier, which in fact continues to control the territory and kill and harass its inhabitants by means of its formidable military might, which is exercised with extraordinary savagery, always with firm U.S. support and participation, crucial fact for us, even before the latest onslaught. The U.S.-Israeli assault on Gaza escalated in January 2006, a few months after the formal withdrawal, because Palestinians committed a real crime. They voted the wrong way in a free election, and that's a serious crime. They have to learn that, like others, easy to add examples, that there's a cost to disobeying the commands of the master, who incidentally continues to prate about his yearning for democracy without eliciting ridicule from the educated classes, which is quite an achievement of our educational and cultural system, one of many. Well, since terrorism, the terms terrorism and aggression are inadequate, some new term is needed for the sadistic and cowardly torture of people who are caged with no possibility of escape, while they're being pounded daily by the most sophisticated products of U.S. military technology, provided in the certain knowledge that this is how they'll be used. It happens to be in direct violation of U.S. law, of course, also international law, but for self-declared outlaw states, that's just another minor technicality, so there's no need to comment on it. Just how serious these weapons are remains to be completely verified. They apparently include white phosphorus, according to Human Rights Watch, which is another violation of the laws of war and who knows what else. One of the heroic volunteers in Gaza, Norwegian doctor, Mad Gilbert, describes his sense of horror as an all-out war goes on against the civilian population of Gaza. He estimates that half the casualties are women and children. The men who are killed are also civilians by any reasonable legal standards, almost all. He says that he has scarcely seen a military casualty among the hundreds of shredded bodies, but that's in accord with the Gur-Evan principles, which I mentioned, and in fact with consistent practice. His estimate is confirmed by the UN humanitarian chief, John Holmes, who informed reporters that it's a fair presumption that most of the civilians killed were women and children in a humanitarian crisis that is worsening day by day as the violence continued. Those who don't like that story can be comforted by the words of Tzipi Livni, who's the leading dove in the electoral system, who assured the world that there is no humanitarian crisis in Gaza, thanks to Israeli benevolence. Like others who care about human beings and their fate, Gilbert and Holmes pleaded for a ceasefire, but not yet. The U.S. blocked the Security Council from issuing a formal statement calling for a ceasefire. There was an official reason, which I'll quote, there was no indication that Hamas would abide by any agreement. Now, of all the justifications that have been offered for delighting in slaughter, this must rank among the most cynical. Of course, that was Bush and Rice. They're soon to be replaced by Barack Obama, who compassionately repeats that if missiles were falling where my two daughters sleep, I would do everything, everything, in order to stop that. He's talking about Israeli children. Beyond that, he's maintained his silence. A few days later, under intense international pressure, the U.S. did back a Security Council resolution which called for what they called a durable ceasefire. It passed 14-0, United States abstaining. Israel and U.S. hawks were angered that the United States did not veto it, as the usual practice is. The abstention, however, does give Israel, if not a green, at least a yellow light to continue with the slaughter. The resolution called for stopping the flow of arms into Gaza, though not into Israel. In fact, vast quantities of arms continued to flow into Israel. On December 30th, 3 days after the latest invasion, the Pentagon released the fact that the U.S. has commissioned several German ships to bring huge quantities of arms from Greece to Israel. They're just, nobody knows what they are. They're labeled ammunition. I think it was 3,000 tons. Very few inquiries to the Pentagon about what's going on were answered with assurance that the arms would arrive too late to be used in the current assault against Gaza, which is probably correct. The Pentagon also said that they're not really intended for Israel, which is also probably correct, but rather they are being prepositioned in Israel. Israel is regarded as an offshore U.S. military base right in the periphery of the most important region of the world, the oil energy producing region. It's one of its contributions, one of its services to U.S. power. And the arms that are prepositioned there will be, if the Pentagon is accurate, not for Israeli violence, but for U.S. violence. So the next act of aggression in the region can make use of the arms stored there for the purpose. There's much more. If it ever gets reported, it will be, you can predict that it will be explained that this is to defend, to protect the free flow of oil and to assure stability. Those are the technical terms used for aggression and criminal violence. Standardly. Well, going back to the UN resolution, did call for stopping the flow of arms into Gaza. In fact, but it also, quote, ensures the sustained reopening of the crossing points on the basis of the 2005 agreement on movement and access between the Palestinian Authority and Israel. Well, what was the 2005 agreement? That determined that the crossings to Gaza would be operated on a continuous basis, that is, never closed, and that Israel would also allow the crossing of goods between Gaza and the West Bank, the two parts of Palestine. In January 2006, the U.S. and Israel abandoned the agreement. That's part of the punishment of Palestinians for voting the wrong way in a free election. We take democracy very seriously here, must be understood. There's a good deal of sober debate these days on what the attackers hope to achieve. I don't think that's very obscure when we take a brief look at recent history. Israel abandoned Gaza in September 2005. Why? Well, rational Israeli hardliners like Ariel Sharon, the patron saint of the settler movement, understood that it was senseless to subsidize a few thousand settlers to live illegally, of course, in the ruins of Gaza, protected by a large part of the IDF, the Israeli army, while they took over, used much of the land and the scarce resources of the territory, including its water. It made much more sense to turn Gaza into what's properly been called the world's largest prison and to and let the people just rot, and to transfer the settlers to the West Bank, which is much more valuable territory, and they can be subsidized illegally to live there, a couple other places. Israel's quite explicit in its intentions about the West Bank in word and in deed. The goal is clearly to, and they say it, to annex the arable land, that's the water supplies, the pleasant suburbs of Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, all of those that lie within what they call the separation wall and annexation wall. It was declared illegal by the World Court, the U.S. Justice agreeing, but of course that's again irrelevant in outlaw states. The territory to be annexed includes a vastly expanded Jerusalem. That's in violation of Security Council orders that go back 40 years. In addition, Israel will take over, and in fact has been taking over, the Jordan Valley. It's about a third of the West Bank that imprisons what's left. The part that's imprisoned is broken into fragments by settled salients, two major salients that basically trisect the territory, and many other settlements, and hundreds of mostly arbitrary checkpoints, which are designed to make life impossible for the two-headed beasts who may remain and will be like drugged roaches scurrying around in a bottle. I'm quoting the highest Israeli political and military leaders, in this case the revered princes, as they're called. The owners of the land may grant the drugged roaches a few scattered parcels, but that's out of goodwill, not by right. Prime Minister Olmert, as you may recall, addressed a joint session of Congress in May 2006, and to rousing applause and a standing ovation, he said, "I believed, and to this day still believe, in our people's eternal and historic right to this entire land." The entire land includes at least everything from the Jordan to the sea, and given his background, it may include Jordan as well, to which it laid, his party laid claim. He also announced a program for what he called convergence. That's for taking over, a program for taking over whatever is valuable in the West Bank, leaving the Palestinians in isolated cantons. Such plans are not new, you know, maybe the details are, but they trace back to the earliest days of the occupation, a few days after the end of the war. Defense Minister Moshe Dayan, who among the Israeli leadership is perhaps the most sympathetic to the Palestinian plight, he explained poetically that the situation today resembles the complex relationship between a Bedouin man and a girl he kidnaps against her will. You Palestinians, as a nation, don't want us today, but we'll change your attitude by forcing our presence on you. You will live like dogs, and whoever will leave, and meanwhile we'll take what we want. That's 1967. At the very moment, there was no doubt that these announced policies were criminal. Immediately after the 1967 war, the Israeli government was informed by its highest legal authority, Theodor Meiron, well-known international figure in international law, They were informed that civilian settlement in the administered territories, which is what they call them, contravenes the explicit provisions of the Fourth Geneva Convention. That's a serious crime, and it's incumbent on all of the high contracting parties, the parties that signed the Geneva Convention, it's incumbent on them to act to prevent such crimes. Of course, they don't do it. The United States not only doesn't do it, but abets the crimes. But again, in an outlaw state, that's an irrelevance, so there's no discussion of it. That's Teodoro Meron. He was supported by Israel's justice minister, concurred in his judgment, and the World Court unanimously endorsed that conclusion in its decision in 2004 on the annexation wall. Meanwhile, the Israeli High Court formally agreed with the World Court while disagreeing in its usual convoluted style, if you look at the judgment. In the West Bank, Israel can pursue its criminal programs with U.S. support and with no disturbance. That's thanks to its effective military control and by now also the cooperation of the collaborationist Palestinian security forces that have been armed and trained by the United States and its allies. It can also carry out regular assassinations and other crimes while the settlers rampage under IDF protection. But while the West Bank has been effectively subdued by terror, there still is resistance in the other half of Palestine, the Gaza Strip. That too has to be quelled for the U.S.-Israeli programs of annexation and destruction of Palestinians to proceed, hence the invasion of Gaza. The timing of the invasion was probably presumably influenced by the coming Israeli elections. Ehud Barak, who runs the invasion, had been lagging badly in the polls, but one Israeli commentator, Ron HaKohen, in the early days of the slaughter, calculated that for every 40 Arabs killed, Barak gains one parliamentary seat. However, the reasons lie much deeper than winning an election. I think the reasons are those that I mentioned. And they're really on the surface. It doesn't take much insight to perceive them. Well, aggression always has a pretext. In this case, there's a mantra that's endlessly repeated. You've heard it 1,000 times in Israel and the United States and in Europe. And the mantra is that Israel has the right to use force to defend itself against Qassam rockets. And that's partially accurate. The rocketing is a criminal act, and it's true that a state has the right to defend itself against criminal attacks, but the claim that a state has the right to use force to do so goes far beyond any principle that we would or should accept. So, for example, I doubt that there are many people here who think that Nazi Germany had a right to defend itself against the terrorism of the partisans, which was quite real. Kristallnacht in 1938 was not justified by the fact that Herschel Greenspan assassinated a German embassy official in Paris. The British were not justified in terrorizing Irish Catholics in response to IRA terror. And incidentally, when they finally sensibly turned to the sensible policy of addressing legitimate grievances in the territory they occupied, the terror ended. It's not a matter of proportionality, that widely used word. It's a matter of choice of action in the first place, proportional or not. Is there a more justified response than violence? Forgetting proportionality. Well, any resort to force always carries a heavy burden of proof. And in every case, including the present case, we have to ask whether it can be met. Can it be met in the case of Israel's effort to quell any resistance to its criminal actions, both in Gaza and in the West Bank, where the criminal actions continue relentlessly? perhaps I may quote myself if you don't mind, in an interview in the Israeli press a couple of years ago on Olmert's announced convergence plans for the West Bank. What I said is that the U.S. and Israel do not tolerate any resistance to these plans, preferring to pretend, falsely of course, that there is no partner as they proceed with programs that go back a long way. We may recall that Gaza and the West Bank are recognized to be a unit, so if resistance to the U.S.-Israeli annexation cantonization programs is legitimate in the West Bank, then it is in Gaza too. I think that's correct. The respected separate question is whether the modality of resistance is legitimate, a totally separate question. We may agree that Herschel Greenspan committed a criminal act and that the partisans committed terror, but that has nothing to do with the question whether Germany had a right to respond with force, same in the British case. So those are just two questions that should be separated. Dr. Mustafa Barghouti is a highly respected Palestinian parliamentarian and official. He reported that since George Bush's Annapolis extravaganza in November 2007, you may recall much impressive rhetoric about dedication to peace and justice, he reports that since November 2007, Israeli attacks on Palestinians escalated sharply with an almost 50% increase in the West Bank, along with a sharp increase in settlements and Israeli checkpoints. Now, quite obviously, these criminal actions are not a response to rockets from Gaza, although the converse may well be the case, as he in fact suggests. Israel has a straightforward means to defend itself. Easy. Put an end to the criminal actions in the occupied territories. That means accept the long-standing international consensus on a two-state settlement on the international border with perhaps minor mutual modifications. That has been an overwhelming international consensus for over 30 years, blocked by the United States and by Israel. That began officially in 1976, Washington's first veto of a Security Council resolution calling for a two-state settlement. I'm not going to run through the rest of the record. There's no time, but it's very clear. Today, U.S.-Israeli rejectionism is even more blatant than it has been in the past, in part because of the Arab League's formal proposal for a settlement that goes beyond the international consensus, calling for full normalization of relations with Israel. Every time you see the word Hamas in the newspapers, it's accompanied by Iranian-supplied Hamas, not U.S.-supplied Israel, and Hamas, which is committed to the destruction of Israel. What you don't read is Hamas, which long ago joined the international consensus on a two-state settlement that the U.S. and Israel bar. That would be excluded in the free press bias. But it's a fact. So the Arab League is calling for normalization. Hamas is calling for a two-state settlement. Iran and Hezbollah have made it clear explicitly that they will abide by any agreement the Palestinians accept. That leaves the United States and Israel in splendid isolation, both in word and also, of course, in actions. They're acting to undermine it and make it impossible day by day. Now, there is one exception, crucial exception, to the persistent rejectionism of the United States and Israel. You'll recall that in 2000, the year 2000, there were negotiations in Camp David which collapsed. Contrary to the standard story, President Clinton recognized that the U.S.-Israeli proposals at Camp David were quite unacceptable, and in December 2000, he presented what he called his parameters. They were kind of vague, but they were more forthcoming. You could at least imagine a settlement in those terms. Clinton also pointed out, gave a speech in which he pointed out that both sides had accepted the parameters and that both sides had reservations. They then met in Taba, Egypt, in January 2001 to resolve the differences, and they came very close to a settlement. In fact, in their final press conference, they said if they'd had a few more days, they could have reached a settlement. The negotiations were canceled at that point by Prime Minister Barak of Israel. That's the one break in 30 years of U.S.-Israeli rejectionism. And I should say that it's not that many years ago. There's no reason why that one break can't be resumed if an American president decides to allow it to be resumed, in which case there will be no shrieks from the famed Israeli lobby, just as there were none at that time, and it could easily be implemented. Well, it's up to us to determine. Well, I've just reported the facts. You can easily affirm them. I'd urge that you verify them. It's not that hard. Give you the sources if you like. But there's a preferred version, which as usual is quite different from the facts. The preferred version, quote Ethan Bronner, the New York Times correspondent in Israel, a preferred version is that many abroad recall Mr. Barak as the prime minister who in 2000 went further than any other Israeli leader in peace offers to the Palestinian, only to see the deal fail and explode in a violent Palestinian uprising that drove him from power. Well, he's partly right. It's true that many abroad believe these fairy tales, thanks to what Bronner and all too many of his colleagues call journalism. There's also a narrower question than the one I've just been discussing. The narrower question puts aside resistance to Israel's ongoing West Bank crimes. And again, when I say Israel, I mean U.S.-Israel crimes, because it can't be done without U.S. Authorization and material and diplomatic and, in fact, ideological support. So put aside all that and just consider Gaza alone. Does Israel have peaceful alternatives to the use of force in response to attacks on its territory, just keeping to Gaza alone? Well, the answer is it surely does. It could accept a ceasefire. Sometimes, in fact, it has accepted a ceasefire while instantly violating it. Now, the most recent case, crucial case, is June 2008. There was a ceasefire that was instituted. It called for opening the border crossings, quoting, to allow the transfer of all goods that were banned and restricted to go into Gaza. Israel agreed, but immediately announced that it would not open the borders until Hamas released Gilad Shalit, an Israeli soldier who was captured by Hamas in June 2006, end of that ceasefire. Well, that's another mantra, incidentally. Everybody's heard about Gilad Shalit and the terrible crime of capturing him and how, till he's released, you know, how can you move towards peace? But that's just more hypocrisy. In fact, the hypocrisy is so blatant, it really is an oppressive feat for Western journalism, especially American journalism and intellectual culture, to suppress it. One day before Hamas captured Shalit, Israeli soldiers entered Gaza City, and kidnapped two civilians, the Muammar brothers, their names are not known. They brought them to Israel, and of course in violation of international law, to join the thousands of other prisoners held there, close to 1,000 without charge. And of course, that had been regular Israeli practice for a long time. I mentioned some of the cases. Now, kidnapping civilians is a far more serious crime than capturing a soldier of an attacking army. But all that remains in memory, allegedly blocking peace, is the capture of Shalit. Again, that reflects the difference in treatment between human beings on the one side and two-legged beasts on the other. Shalit should be returned in a fair prisoner exchange. But try to find an honest comment on this anywhere. It was after the capture of Shalit that Israel's military attack passed from vicious to truly sadistic. But it's well to remember that even before his capture in June 2006, Israel had fired more than 7,700 shells at northern Gaza since its September withdrawal, eliciting virtually no comment, maybe none. Israel has maintained the siege ever since it rejected the June 2008 ceasefire that it accepted. A siege is an act of war, justifying massive violence in response. Now, that's a point on which Israel has always insisted when its own access to the outside world is hampered in any way. In fact, it's the justification for major wars. So if that's true, it surely should be a justification for rockets. Israel went so far in the siege as to prevent the UN Relief and Works Administration, the UN agency that keeps Palestinians alive. It kept them from even replenishing their stores. So when the ceasefire broke down, we ran out of food for the 750,000 people who depend on us. That's John Ging, the Irish director of UNRWA, informing the BBC. Well, despite the continuing Israeli siege, again, a serious act of war, rocketing sharply reduced during the period of the ceasefire. The ceasefire broke down last November, November 4th, with an Israeli raid into Gaza. The raid was very carefully timed, as usual. It came shortly before Hamas Fatah talks in Cairo that were aimed at reconciling their differences and creating a single unified government. That would have been the first such meetings since the Civil War in June 2007 that left Hamas in control of Gaza, and it would have been a significant step towards advancing diplomatic efforts. So it was quite useful to undercut that danger by violating the ceasefire and invading Gaza, killing six people. The civil war itself was instigated by the United States and Israel. It was a very crude attempt to carry out a military coup to overthrow the democratically elected government that the United States opposes. Again, pretty standard practice. Well, the blockade was tightened further after November 4th, disastrous consequences for the population. Both sides escalated violence. All the deaths were Palestinian, and that continued until the ceasefire formally ended on December 19th, and Prime Minister Olmert authorized the full-scale invasion. A few days before that, about a week before, Hamas had proposed to return to the original July ceasefire agreement, which Israel had not observed. That offer was transmitted to a senior official in the Israeli army by Robert Pastor. He's an academic historian and a former Carter administration high official. But Israel did not respond, except by launching the invasion. Of course, Israel was aware of it. The head of Shin Bet, that's the Internal Security Agency, was quoted in Israeli sources on December 21st as saying that Hamas is interested in continuing the calm with Israel while its military wing is continuing preparation for conflict. Okay, so no calm. We'd rather have conflict. Israel's senior diplomatic correspondent, Akiva Eldar, reports that shortly before Israel launched its full-scale invasion on Saturday, December 27th, Hamas, I'm quoting him, Hamas Politburo Chief Khaled Meshaal proposed ceasefire and return to the arrangement of 2005, which permitted continuous opening of the crossings for desperately needed supplies. The response was the invasion. In a front page think piece on the latest Gaza invasion, New York Times correspondent Stephen Lee Myers writes that in some ways the attack on Gaza was reminiscent of the gamble Israel took in Lebanon in 1982 when it invaded to eliminate the threat of Yasser Arafat's forces. He's correct. There is a similarity and the threat is the same. He's correct, but not in the sense he had in mind. In 1982, as in 2008, the threat was the threat of political settlement, and it was crucially necessary to eliminate that threat. That's, again, standard practice. I mean, it's not that Israel does not want peace. Of course it wants peace. Everyone wants peace. Hitler wanted peace, for example. The question is, on what terms? From its origins, long before the establishment of the state, the Zionist movement has understood that to achieve its goals, it would have to delay political settlement, and meanwhile slowly building facts on the ground as the basis for some eventual settlement. Even the occasional agreements, as in 1947, were recognized by the leadership to be temporary steps towards further expansion. The 1982 war is a dramatic illustration of the need for undercutting the threat of political settlement. It was called pretty openly in Israel a war for the West Bank. If we can get rid of the diplomatic efforts of the Palestinians, which were becoming very annoying, we can continue to take over the West Bank at the cost of the destruction of Lebanon and the killing of thousands of people. The 1982 Lebanon war was followed by Israeli support for Hamas, so as to undermine the secular PLO and its dangerous peace initiatives. Another case that should be familiar, if it isn't, is Israeli provocations before the 1967 war, which were designed to elicit a Syrian response that could be used as a pretext for Israeli violence and for the takeover of more land. That's at least 80% of the incidents, according to Defense Minister Moshe Dayan. This effort, persistent effort, to delay political accommodation has always made perfect sense. It's not irrational. And the same is true of the hysterical lies about how there is no partner. There simply is no other way to take over land where you're not wanted. So it's sensible. And for the same reasons, similar reasons, Israel has consistently preferred expansion to security. That's been particularly evident since 1971, when Israel made a really fateful decision, I think, backed by Henry Kissinger, namely the decision to reject the offer of a full peace treaty by President Sadat of Egypt, which incidentally offered nothing to the Palestinians. It's an agreement that Israel and the United States were compelled to accept at Camp David 8 years later. It's after a major war, which was a near disaster for Israel and immense suffering. Now that goes down in history as a wonderful achievement of U.S. Involvement in bringing peace. In fact, it was a diplomatic catastrophe for the reasons I mentioned, but that's beyond the capacity of educated people to discuss or think about. Again, I urge you to look at the facts if you're interested. Now, a peace treaty with Egypt in 1971, which the U.S. and Israel rejected, that would have ended any significant security threat. There was none from the Palestinians, and Egypt is the major Arab military force by far. But there was an unacceptable quid pro quo. Sadat insisted that Israel abandon its extensive settlement programs in Egypt, namely in the northeastern Sinai. And as usual, security was a lower priority than expansion, as it still is. Today, Israel could have security, normalization of relations, integration into the region. But it very clearly prefers illegal expansion, conflict, repeated exercise of violence, to teach lessons to the two-legged beasts, actions that are severely eroding its security, even if it gains short-term military victory. One of the wisest voices in Israel, unfortunately a tiny minority, Uri Avneri, recently wrote that after an Israeli military victory in Gaza, what will be seared into the consciousness of the world will be the image of Israel as a blood-stained monster, ready at any moment to commit war crimes and not prepared to abide by any moral restraints. This will have severe consequences for our long-term future, our standing in the world, our chance of achieving peace and quiet. In the end, this war is a crime against ourselves, too, a crime against the State of Israel. It's good reason to believe that he's right. If I can quote myself again, several decades ago, 30 years ago, I wrote that those who call themselves supporters of Israel are in reality supporters of its moral degeneration and its probable ultimate destruction. And regrettably, that judgment looks more and more plausible. Meanwhile, we're observing a very rare moment in history. It's what the late Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling called politicide. It's the murder of a nation at our hands.
If you have questions for Professor Chomsky, you should go to the mics, as I said earlier, and just line up, and we'll recognize you as time permits.
I see one.
Yeah,
the other one.
The one you can never see.
Okay.
Yes. Good morning. I'm Professor Chomsky, and my question is about. The American consensus about the support for Israel's role as part of America's geopolitical future. Recently, there was a letter in the Financial Times about how our support for Israel is such a huge geostrategic gift to China and other competitors.
It's a huge what?
Geostrategic gift to China.
To China?
And the other competitors.
Yeah.
Are we seeing a crack in the consensus about the role of Israel?
It's a serious question. One can debate whether it's been wise for the United States to take the position of extreme support for Israeli violence and terror, expansion, criminal acts, to reject political settlement. That's a question that can be asked. What we do know is that American elites think it's right. I mentioned the military, which is very happy with it. Partly because Israel is just a major and obedient military base. In fact, back in 1958, the U.S. intelligence concluded that support for Israel is a logical corollary of our opposition to what they call radical Arab nationalism. Radical just means independent, not following orders. So yes, it's a logical corollary to support for to opposition to Arab independent Arab nationalism. And if you look at in 1967, when the relations really became firm, it was a reaction, immediate reaction to a major service that the United States, that Israel performed for the United States and for its major allies, Saudi Arabia, namely destroying the basis for secular Arab nationalism in the region. Abdel Nasser's Egypt. And so it continues. And up till today, the military is quite happy to have an obedient, powerful military force, according it's Israel's air and armored forces, small country, but its air and armored forces are larger and technologically more advanced than any NATO power outside the United States, of course, it's because it's an offshoot of the United States. Israeli and U.S. military industry are very highly integrated, so much so that one of Israel's major arms producers actually shifted its executive offices to the United States. American high-tech industry is very enthusiastic about Israel. You can tell that just by looking at investment flows. They've been shooting up, including the major corporations, Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft, Intel, Warren Buffett, and so on. So they apparently think it's fine. American educated elites think it's fine. Ever since 1967, they were very impressed by Israel's military capacity and have maintained that delight in being supportive of a major, powerful military force. Of course, always with a humanistic cover, but that's normal. So the fact of the matter is that across the spectrum of major actors, they seem to be pretty happy about it. Is it wise? You could debate it. I mean, I don't think it's wise. As I said, I don't think it's good for Israel. I think they made a terrible mistake in 1971 by refusing peace, security, and insisting on expansion. And in fact, they were later compelled by force to back away from that expansion. That's Camp David, continue with other expansion. But, that's my judgment. I don't determine policy. But yes, it's a fair question. Could be asked.
Thank you. First of all, I just would like to offer my condolences. I would like you to elaborate a little on you talked about the plan. This was planned in a military sense and planned in a propaganda sense. And I would like to ask you to elaborate on aspects of the way in which the propaganda side has been given expression in a couple of areas. First of all, I noticed that CNN and Reuters, among other major corporate media, use the term incursion repeatedly. Secondly, another reporter from the New York Times, you mentioned Ethan Bronner, Stephen Erlanger, who was reporting from Jerusalem, had a story reporting on what Israeli military sources had discussed with him, apparently, regarding people with weapons in Gaza in civilian clothes popping out of holes and went into other details. And thirdly, there was interesting timing to me of a major front page feature story based presumably on timed leaks regarding Iran and Iranian, the fact that the Bush administration had supposedly said to Israel that they would not be authorized to fly over Iraq to bomb alleged nuclear facilities, but that instead the Bush administration were intensifying covert operations against those alleged programs in Iran. And finally, the interesting fact that Olmert supposedly spoke out against the occupation only weeks before launching this major invasion.
Okay, I'm not sure I got everything, but the meticulous planning of the invasion is discussed extensively in the Israeli press, and to some extent here too. So, and it describes both aspects, the military planning and the propaganda effort. And it's how effective it's been, one could argue. There's one area where it's very effective in American elite opinion and in the press, but probably not among the population. The only poll I've seen shows the population very divided, roughly 50-50 on the invasion, despite the massive propaganda, which is just replicated almost without deviation in the media, including the examples you mentioned. As for reliance on Israeli military sources, well, of course, that's part of the propaganda system, kind of like the U.S. in Iraq, where reporters could go in if they were embedded, and meaning propaganda agents. Freelance reporters who tried to report, some of them were just dropped out of the corporate media. Others could do it as freelancers. In the case of Gaza, Israel has simply barred all reporters, foreign or it's even Israeli, because they want to make sure that there's no direct reporting. I mean, what you can get is, you know, cell phone calls or something like that, and reports from people like not Gilbert, this Norwegian doctor, and UN officials, and so on. But that's all part of what they call their Hasbara campaign. Now, Israel has two words, Hebrew, there are two words for propaganda. One of them is standard word for propaganda. The other, Hasbara, is for their own propaganda. And the word means explanation. The tacit assumption is that everything we do is so obviously right that all we have to do is explain it to people, and then they'll understand why we're actually exactly right. And that Hasbara campaign does work among American intellectuals and Western European intellectuals generally. As for the populations, it's an open question. I should say even on the rejectionism, although it's almost 100% supported by the educated sectors and the media and so on. Of course, it's not called that. The facts are always suppressed. It's not among the population. Roughly two-thirds of the population is in favor of the Arab League plan, normalization of relations within the international borders, basically the international consensus. But as usual, public opinion has almost no effect on policy. It's an interesting fact about American democracy. It's in fact a matter of principle. There's kind of principled reasons which go back to James Madison or why that has to be the case. And it clearly is the case, and the public knows it. So about 95% of the public objects that public opinion is not taken into account by the government. But, they're two-legged beasts, too. They don't really understand important things. That's part of the control. About the civilians popping out of holes, you can pull that straight out of Nazi propaganda, British propaganda during the Revolutionary War, in fact, any imperial war. I mean, any invading imperial power would be delighted if people who are resisting put on uniforms and stood out in an open field so they could be destroyed by overwhelming military force. And they get very upset when Minutemen and others don't accept these rules. They should be wearing red coats like the Hessian soldiers, the British mercenaries. That's a standard. I mean, what's interesting is that I think you said Erlanger could even repeat such nonsense without collapsing in ridicule. About Iran, we don't know the details, but the reports are interesting. They do indicate two things. One, that the U.S. barred Israel from overflying Iraq, which would make it very difficult for them to attack Iran. The other aspect is that they apparently admitted that they're carrying out terrorist actions inside Iran. That's not the first time. There's been evidence of that for some time, including major terrorist acts from Pakistan and Afghanistan. But again, that's normal for an outlaw state. The lack of support for an Israeli attack is interesting. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that Israel does not want, that the United States does not want Israel to attack Iran. That could lead to a major conflagration with huge effects for American troops, for oil supplies, everything else. It wasn't much discussed, but there was a resolution, a congressional resolution, debated in the House, H.R. 362, I think it was, which called for the U.S. to, in effect, impose a blockade on Iran, bar shipping in the Gulf and so on. It had enormous support. AIPAC, the Israeli lobby, was passionately in support of it, pulling out all the strings. It initially had overwhelming congressional support, but it was voted down. It was voted down in part thanks to lobbying by the anti-war movement, which is hardly a massive lobby in the United States. But it was voted down mainly because the U.S. government didn't want it. And the lobby consistently slinks away silently when it comes into conflict with U.S. power, for good reasons. They know they haven't got a chance, and they want to harm themselves. And this passed very calmly as well, many other such cases. As for Olmert, he did say, in basically in his resignation speech, he had to resign because of charges of corruptions. So he resigned, and he's still in office, but basically resigned. And he did make a speech. He didn't make a speech. He had an interview in the press at that time in which he withdrew all of his earlier positions, all of them, and said that Israel must accept the international consensus as to withdraw from the occupied territories and maybe modification of borders agreed upon, mutual modification agreed upon by both sides. In fact, he went back to essentially the Taba proposals, which, as I say, were almost realized, except that Israel blocked them at the end. That was his resignation speech. And it's interesting. It shows that he understood. And as you say, it was followed very shortly by rejection of